Blog Talk Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الرحمن الرحيم. مالك يوم الدين. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Latifa A. Hameen, the CEO for American Muslim 360, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice is protected.
The views expressed by the host guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM 360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Shura Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM 360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific personal, medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM 360 or CWSC. We encourage you to seek an advisor for your specific circumstance. Now Joshua fought the battle of Jericho,
and the walls came tumbling down. Community-Wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360 invite you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected. Affordable rates allow you to promote your event, product, or service and strengthen our national intelligentsia network. Contact corporate underwriting today at info@cwsc.us. That's info@cwsc.us. Or call 910-317-0297. Again, 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world.
Monday morning. How are you, madam? How are you? How are you doing? How's it going?
Oh, doing pretty good. Alhamdulillah. Thank Allah. Good to be speaking, as I say. No heard.
Yay. Good to be heard on this day of commemoration of good Reverend Dr. King. Speaking of freedom and liberation. All those things that they did not want to give him praises for when he was living.
For sure, yeah.
They took him out. It's okay. Yeah. I always feel some kind of about that. Let that part go. I know we'll be missing our brother Fleming today. We want to Please give some love to Brother Flynn this morning.
And his wife, Sister Cassandra, and their children, family, and friends.
Yes, ma'am.
Those in our audience who do not know, Brother Fleming's son, Matthew Abraham Elamine, passed away last week. His janazah funeral service was on Saturday, I believe. So our prayers are with Brother Fleming and Sister Cassandra and his siblings of Brother Matthew. We pray that Allah will make it, that God will make it easy for them during this time of trial, and that their faith will be increased. Inshallah. That Matthew's sins will be forgiven and that he will have a good place in the paradise, inshallah. We know that's a tough one. And our children pass away.
Yes. When you even pretend to know about these ones. These ones is hard. And it's kind of why you want to put a couple of, before we get into that, I want to just to bring up one person of the weightedness stuff. That kind of burden were into our hearts and minds, and how we manage these things of the weekend, they talk about what we do talk, right? We talk about news items. And there's a couple of them that we should bring up. We've got a bunch of news items this week that sink in. That last week we talked about the professor Claudine Gay, who became the president of Harvard last week. And since she's not a professor, and what happened to her, and this seems to be, it's starting to be a trend around the country. And why it needs something different than just for her being the president of Harvard, it was an issue. Why black women in particular was taking it hard. So today's show is going to focus on mainly that. There is another incident this past week. I talked to you about it actually yesterday, of the vice president of student affairs at Lincoln University in Missouri, an HBCU, who Dr. Antoinette Candia Bailey, it's important we say her name, who reportedly died by suicide from bullying and severe mistreatment in her role as vice president. Mostly by the hands of the president of the college, who are you? And the only reason I'm saying that he is a white man is for context, at this historically black college university. There were other incidences, but his was the pervasive one as someone who she was reporting to. She filed complaints that were not adhered to, and even the investigation that the school conducted, the letter indicated that it was her fault for not being able to handle this professor. He found that even if the professor was harsh, they did not find that he was, you know, she should be able to deal with it better. For most black women, this tends to be, you know, the example they were living. Someone said, what do we do about this? But first, have you been able to see or read anything about this case, sister?
Just very quickly on the surface. I didn't read a lot of information about it, but I know that you have. So I'm interested in hearing what you have to say.
Yeah, is this one, and then there's another. So you have, let's look at, so I'm gonna put a pause on this one. I want to look at some other news items. There's a couple other news items that I want to bring to your attention. But I wanted to start off with, do you have a favorite quote from Dr. King?
Do I have, I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear, understand what you said.
A favorite quote from Dr. King.
Oh,
this
you know,
is Dr.
My
King.
Husband, yeah, yeah. My husband was mentioning one to me this morning that really touched him, and when I thought about it too, it brought back a lot of memories. And it was very straightforward and very simple, applying to the Vietnam War, where Dr. King said, "We are on the side of the oppressor. We are on the side of the oppressor." And it's applicable today with what we see going on in the world today with our foreign policy. So, yes, that is a very timely quote, I think. There's one that is pretty famous in terms of silence is complicity. I mean, you know, he's just had so many insightful statements that he made.
I like it.
What's your favorite?
1960, Founders Day at Selma College. I have it on the door of my. If you can't fly, run. If you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl. By all means, keep moving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
That's motivation.
I mean, sure. Yes, he's from the bigger, you know, it's from the larger speech, but I like it because I like it because there's no excuse. It gives you no excuse for not doing something. There's an implication that there's room in the movement for freedom and liberation for everyone. You can take that quote and you can, you know, move it around for anything, right? Okay, you can't speak it. And because her language, you can do something else. You can't do this, you can do this. But you can do something to keep this movement towards liberation moving forward. But I love the imagery of it, but I love the premise that you must keep moving. We must keep moving. We must keep moving forward. So, this is one of my favorite ones. The second thing I wanted to ask you is there's a huge conversation about the co-opting of Dr. King's legacy.
Yeah.
so I wanted to start you about that. Do you have anything on that? Any thoughts on this?
Well, yes, I know there has been quite a bit of conversation. I remember last year this time it talked around his daughter Bernice was very annoyed at how some of the, what you would say, extreme right conservatives, how they have claimed to some of Dr. King's quotes to promote their thought or their ideology, and she took exception to that. You know, because they on one hand, they will spew out a Dr. King quote, and then on the other hand, they will talk about being woke, you know, and how being woke has caused so much problem in our country, and how the teaching of African American history is divisive and makes people feel uncomfortable. So you see the paradox, and you also see, to me, you see the devilish mind or devilish scheme to really undermine good, to undermine motivating people to come together. They use the same words or quotes to separate and to draw division in people. So, and you know, I think that's something that is with us, is going to be with us for a while until more and more people become aware and really push back against that kind of manipulation. And it's a challenge because the technology today to spread disinformation, propaganda, whatever you want to call it, to more and more people. And I don't remember the exact figures, but I remember seeing a poll about maybe people in America today spend at least 8 hours of listening to or absorbing information from social media sites, you know, TV maybe, but generally they stick to one source, so that they suck in all of the information from that one source as opposed to checking it and getting a broader view of a particular issue. So, yeah, I kind of went off there, but the words of Dr. King and others, you know, they've done this not so much with El-Haj Malik Shabazz, Malcolm X, but definitely with Dr. King. His approach, his nonviolent approach, is more. Although, if you do some reading of his speeches after the March on Washington, you know, especially with his speeches against the war in Vietnam, there are some dynamic thoughts that Dr. King had in terms of liberation and working for liberation, even though they may have been nonviolent. You know, his methodology, his rhetoric could be considered very revolutionary.
Yeah, I think that has that was a biographer who said that, you know, a lot of Americans are missing the whole point of the King's holiday, because, you know, he was a champion of American democracy, and, you know, he was a foot soldier. Black Freedom Struggle, Civil Rights Movement, and, you know, voting rights and everything that Black Americans were deprived of, including, you know, digital segregation and tearing down Jim and Jane Crow, white supremacist terror regime, and ensuring fundamental human and civil rights. Black, poor whites, all people, right, on both sides, the color line, protecting the laws of America should protect everyone, and having this so-called Third America, and after the Second Reconstruction, is not what he was preaching about. So, he was assassinated when he was supporting the strike of sanitation workers in Memphis, because he was representing, you know, it was a fundamental threat to the white racial order and American apartheid. And people don't want to say those words. We're going to remake history. So we're in this age of 45 where we have this ascendant neo-fascism where it's, you know, this, I don't like the word white supremacy, but this so-called, there's a reinvigoration of the same type of political and social forces that caused Dr. King to be so-called martyred and Malcolm X to be so-called martyred. And much of what all the gains that we had during the Civil Rights Movement to be peeled back. That's what's happening now, right? And another quote that we often hear, which I also like, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Everything that's happening now is when I hear people who caused substantial harm and then try to use Dr. King's words to justify causing harm to Black and brown people, to people who live in poverty, to whether they're, you know, poverty does not know color, to people with disabilities, to the elderly, to children, especially in these multiple conflicts that are happening around the world, and use Dr. King's words in saying that, you know, he believes in nonviolence, and you're using these words, and you're almost corrupting those words.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You're manipulating and corrupting those words to try and make that arc of justice do a back bend. Tired or not, is what I'm just perplexed. Yeah, I just believe that it is local. You know, you're missing. You're not even trying to understand the point. You're trying to conflate his words being into. It's like reading a religious text and picking out certain words for your benefit, and not reading it in context. And that is what we see a lot of, because people don't want to recognize what they're doing is incorrect. They're not trying to have a pluralistic democracy or a multiracial democracy, or a democracy that works for more than one small sector of people. It is right.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And then on the flip side, the other part that I see that has been, if I can use the word bastardized, is the commercialization of the Dr. King holiday, the community give back day, the community service day, the let me put something in the stores day, week. Let's see how much free labor we can get out of people with this community service. But how much of that is really going back to the organizations that are serving the people? I thought you can see it a little bit with President's Week and President's Day, but you're really seeing it even more now with Dr. King Day, and there's having sales now. And it's not just celebrations. It's celebrations, and I mean, I personally take offense, and you tell me if I'm being, I mean, tell me my slip is showing on the, you know what, my wig is tilted, but, you know, my curls are coming undone. My hijab is tilted. So I usually have an issue when I go to, you know, Berkeley did a good job this morning. They have the Berkeley breakfast is still going on. It's the 13th annual celebration. But, you know, now Cerrito has one, and Oakland will have one today. There were several this weekend. I take issue with celebrations for the good Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And there's a predominant presence of non-black people. It is something that I take issue with. Perhaps I shouldn't. You can tell me that my hijab is on too tight. Maybe one of the pins is sticking me. But I take issue with it.
Why do you take issue with it? I guess that would be the question. Why do you see it happening that way?
I see it a lot where it's people who call themselves, and I don't like this word either, and this is another one of my, and it's just a pet peeve of mine when people use these words in the wrong way. People call themselves, you know, so-called allies, and they want to, I'm an ally. I want to show my alliance to the community. Well, when I see an ally, whether it is the Black community, the Latino community, the Asian community, API community, the community, the Muslim community, the community, you know, for even the Jewish community or the veteran community, people with disabilities, you should sit back and see what is needed. You don't put yourself prominent. And, you know, if you are a male and you come into a women's space, you sit back. You don't put yourself prominent. If this is not your space, the best allies are people who know how to sit back and see how you can be helpful. Don't put yourself in the forefront. I don't care that you're the governor of the state of California. If you are, you know, the best thing you can do is to say, thank you for inviting me to this space. I am here to observe. I am here to provide. I am here to let you know that I am here in support of the celebration, but I don't want to take away from the celebration. Thank you very much. And sit down somewhere. If you come into a celebration of people with disabilities and you are not one, sit down somewhere. As my grandmother would say, don't come here taking up space and taking up attention. There's certain spaces that I don't go to because I don't want the attention to be on me. I want the attention to be on whoever it is for. Especially, like, I used to do that for my children when it was their events or whatever. I like to slip in the back and sit in the back. I don't want people to put the attention on me. That's why. You have a different take?
There's a lot there. I understand what you were saying. I can agree with it. I can also see the part that concerns me in that type of hypothetical is why aren't there enough members of the African American community to take the lead or to be involved so that their numbers are not so small or so insignificant, or the role that they play is insignificant. So I think that it is incumbent on, well, number one, I think that the idea of service should be a 365, 366 a year attitude or disposition or emphasis. And you can recognize the service that people have done throughout the year, maybe on this one particular day, if that's the thrust of the King celebration. And I think that for that to happen, there's a lot that has to happen in the community, first of all, for the members of the community to be aware of what did Dr. King stand for, what did he do, so to have a knowledge of that history of why are we celebrating this man? What did he do? What was accomplished? If we talk about voting rights, we're still struggling for voting rights right now. The legislation, has the Congress passed the legislation to secure voting rights? Why do we still have debate in our national civic life as far as election integrity and security? Why are so many people still enthralled in this lie that 45 has perpetuated as far as an election stolen? You know, so all of these things come into play. If we look at the young people, say if we look at from middle school to sophomore in college in predominantly urban centers where you might have African American, Latino, Asian, where you have people who have been on the margins. Although their numbers, you know, when you look at all of their numbers together, and this is what has people so afraid in terms of this great replacement theory, if you add up the numbers of the Hispanics, the African Americans, the Asian, other API folks that you're talking about, those are the dominant people in the society. It's not the necessarily the Caucasian people. Okay, so how can a few keep so many down? Because they use and they employ that old technique of divide and conquer. And so if we don't take active roles in the schools to make sure that the curriculum is taught properly so that children know who was Dr. King and why should I even care about this man and what he did. Even though it is going to make some people uncomfortable. I saw a quote from Maya Angelou and I should have written it down, but it was something to the effect of, even though looking at history makes you uncomfortable, looking back at history makes you uncomfortable, that doesn't mean that we have to relive it, was the point that she was making. And so I think that when we have these celebrations, if you don't see enough African-American, Latino, Asian, API people in that audience, then to me that's reflecting the leadership in that community is not doing its job. And so they have a goal to work for the next year, to have more young people in there, to have more elders in there, to have more people who have benefited from the work of Dr. King participating in these types of celebrations. And but more importantly, being active the whole year round. So that's kind of my take on it. And for true transparency, haven't gone to a lot of these kind of celebration type things, especially in the last 5 or 6 years. So I may not be the best person to make a comment on that. I don't know if anyone in our audience has a comment. You know, it's just, and it might be, okay, I'm going to tell my age here. I think I was 13 when the March on Washington happened, and I really wanted to go, but my mother wouldn't let me go. I was raised by single parent, my mom, and also my grandmother, her mother. And they were like, you're crazy. You're 13 years old. You're not going to Washington, D.C. We're not going. We don't know anyone who's going. You are not going. You're going to stay right here and look at it on TV. So at the time, I was what they call candy striper. I don't know if they still have those in the healthcare. They probably do. But what a candy striper was would be, you know, usually a teenager who would volunteer in the hospital doing little, you know, maybe administrative stuff. Maybe I think I took the x-ray things from the x-ray department up to the department that it belonged to, that kind of stuff. And it just so happened I was there at the hospital, was Sydenham Hospital in New York City, and they showed the march, and I was just so overcome by to see that many people at one place talking about freedom. So this was sort of like a part of my my spirit of activism being ignited in me. And then when I fast forward to when Dr. King was killed, I was in college, but my whole feeling towards him had kind of flipped, because now I was just more into that militant mode, you know, water cannons on you and dogs fighting at you and people shooting at you and whatnot, to me, was not getting the freedom that we wanted, and I was impatient. And, of course, now that you get older and you realize this is a big monster that we are trying to change, this United States of America, you know, trying to change people's minds and their thoughts and their actions is a big job. And so that's why your quote that you mentioned earlier is so apropos in terms of you got to keep on going, whether it's flying, walking, crawling, whatever it is. You've got to keep on going because this is a humongous, this is a huge task that's before us, and we can't give up. We can't get discouraged. Unfortunately, the gains that were made by that whole civil rights movement, you know, I think a lot has been gained, but I don't know if the majority of the people who benefited from some of those gains really appreciate and appreciate the struggle that went into what we can enjoy today. You know, you go and you sit in the bus, you go into the movie theater, wherever you want to go, you go to the mall and go into whatever store you want. And yeah, they follow you around because of, you know, what's been going on with craziness, with people stealing and shoplifting and everything. But do you think about the number of people who died for you to be able to do that in San Francisco, California, or Dothan, Alabama, or Jackson, Mississippi. So we just have a big job ahead of us still. I'm not going to say anymore because I feel rambling.
Well, the quote that you mentioned from Maya Angelou, yeah, I have that one. I actually have it on my board. It's history, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be lived, but if faced with courage, need not be lived again.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I, just so, and yes, I agree with you on a couple of points. We need to teach the students and some adults. There's some adults who never learn these things. Found out what I learned in the Midwest. They did not learn in California. They just did not have, you know, a black, and they still don't for the most part have the same type of robust civics and social studies that we had growing up in the Midwest that they did out here, which I was quite amazed about. However, I think what I'm speaking of is that there's a purposeful move to have this inclusive type of environment to the detriment of the meaning of celebrations. We don't see this in other so-called communities. When we have a community event, it's almost like we feel some kind of draw to defer to everyone else instead of feeling like, no, you know what? You'll see it during Black History Month. Right? This is a Black History celebration. How you walk into a Black History celebration and it's everybody but Black people on the dice or on the speaker's panel? I'm not walking into a Black History celebration and the forum is everybody but a Black person. No, I don't need, you know, Annabelle telling me about Black History. No. That's what I'm talking about. It's been co-opted. Is, you know, you walk into Target and it's been commercialized to the point where it's no longer about, you know, Dr. King or Malcolm X or Miss Coretta Scott. Or it's not about the history anymore. It's about how can I be seen and affiliated. How can I make money, but how can I also put myself in the light of how can I put myself in this light rather than focusing on the point? So people are missing the point of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I mean by that. It's like you don't walk into a room full of, and I'm going to go back to people with disabilities. If you don't have a disability, trying to teach people what it is to be hearing impaired or vision impaired or blind or paraplegic or quadriplegic. If you're not a quadriplegic, if you're not a paraplegic, even blind, and it is this, not only disingenuous, it's disrespectful. And that is how I view it. Don't come to me telling me because you have empathy that you should be able to tell me, you should be able to tell me what they you should be able to participate because you have empathy. I really like Shirley Chisholm. She's one of my favorite people. Can't I participate? James Baldwin is my favorite. One of my favorite authors. I'm a Black, but can't I participate in the ceremonies? Because, you know, I'm a gay man too. I'm not Black, but I'm a gay man too. So I really like Bayard Rustin. So can I participate? But I know the story of Rosa Parks. Can I participate? And Dorothy Height and Jesse Owens. I'm a runner too. And I grew up knowing about Jesse Owens. Or Bessie Coleman, or, you know, the new other people in our history, Gwendolyn Brooks, and, you know, or and Gordon Parks. I have a friend who's a photographer who always talks about Gordon Parks. And while it's okay, you have to not, I think that part of my issue is how prominent a role you should take in these celebrations, if the celebration is about a particular thing, right? In Berkeley, I was at a powwow, and that's what it was called, a powwow. And though our family has Native American roots, my husband's father grew up on the reservation, we still sat back and took a particular and took a seat. We didn't demand to be put on the front row of the Native celebration. So I think it's what I'm having problems with, sister. You know?
So the prominence that, or coming up front, is what irritates you.
It irritates me. At the Ruby Bridges celebration in Richmond, he's like, why are you sitting in the front row and you got these young black people or these black people who need to be understanding who Ruby Bridges was and what this was about and why we have the Ruby Bridges Day and why we have the, you know, why we have the Rosa Parks Day and why we have Ruby Bridges Walk to School Day. He's like, why people don't get up and give up their seat for an elder person or a pregnant woman, or understanding that from just an elementary standpoint is it, well, I'm tired too. I heard a man say that. I'm tired too. I'm a big man. I'm fat. My feet hurt too. Well, your neck gonna hurt in a minute because I'm about to slap you upside your head. What are you talking about? I'm tired too. My back and my feet hurt too. That is an old woman. That is an elder. What are you talking about? That is what I'm talking about. We've lost that aspect. Well, I'm one quarter Creek. I can see here. What? What are you talking about? It seems like that. I'm 1/8 Native. I'm 1/16 Native. I can see here. No, you're not. No, you can't. Go sit in the back.
Let me divert something for a minute. This was humorous to me. I was reading something. I think it's on Pocket. If you have Firefox, maybe if you get Pocket, and it was talking about the 9th Vice President of the United States was a guy by the name of Richard Johnson, and he was married to an enslaved woman. And I'll just cut through the whole story. I mean, it was known that he was married to this enslaved woman. They couldn't get officially married, although he did marry her in the church because of the laws at the time. And the Southern people opposed his nomination to run as the vice president with Van Buren, I believe. But anyway, Van Buren won. Johnson didn't. He was missing one electoral vote to become the vice president. The Congress had to vote to make him the vice president. He became the vice president. They had two daughters, Imogene and Adeline. One of the daughters married a Pence, P-E-N-C-E. I thought that was hilarious. I wonder if Pence, when you said I'm 1/8 Crete and I'm 1/16, and the thing was, they said that in the article, they were saying that the daughters, you know, after the father was dead and whatnot, there was only one daughter left. She was the one that was married to this guy named Pence. that their family members did not make it known that they were descended from Richard Johnson, because they were passing for Caucasian. They were passing for white. So I just thought that was hilarious. And I'm thinking about, does Mike Pence know what is in his family tree? So just a little bit of diversion tidbit that I'm going to bring it back to maybe the Ruby Bridges, the Rosa Parks, the Martin Luther Kings. Maybe they have to belong to everybody. But I know what you're talking about. You're talking about co-opting our heroes, our history, our struggle and everything. And it's complicated. I don't know how it's going to shake out for us here in this country as far as if we can get away from this this racial divide that we have. But, you know, God willing, we'll be able to overcome that hurdle.
Exactly. That's all. I just believe that, you know, sometimes we get into this want to be so relevant that we forget what really is important and relevant.
That's right.
I want to pivot, but I want to do a quick commercial break because I want to talk about what's going on at Rice University.
Right here in
Berkeley? Rice University and it's in Houston. And it's astrochemistry class.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Hold on to your hijab. Hold your hijab. It's about to shift. It's about to shift. We have gone off the deep end. Hold on. Don't touch that. Be right back.
Okay.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Edward Willis, advisor at Graceline Community, asking you to join me in supporting community-wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360. Make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or phone in your pledge to 910-317-0297. Again, make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or by phone at 910-317-0297. Together, we can remake the world. Thank you.
Join us live every Wednesday morning from 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time with host Naima Latif and yours truly, Imam Kareem Hamid, presenting The Female Solution. We look forward to your presence. Assalamu alaikum.
Peace be with you and welcome to Positive Solutions to Critical Issues, hosted by yours truly, Dr. Jamal Rashid and instructor Henry Hasid. This program is sociologically as well as psychologically inclined, with Fitler as its base. We examine the root seed to multiple effects that impact our holistic daily lives. So tune in each and every Thursday morning from 7 to 8 Eastern Standard Time here on American Muslim 360. Thank you and have a pleasant day.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Dabrita Hadi, Director of the MCNRD Model Community National Resource Directory, reminding volunteers of our upcoming MCNRD Social Connect Conference every last Sunday of the month, 1 o'clock p.m. to 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We look forward to your participation, so please check your email for conference call information. Thank you so kindly. Assalamu alaikum.
Okay, sister. So Rice University in Houston, Dr. Brooke Johnson is teaching class. It doesn't count towards the chemistry major. She wants to explore the intersection of racial justice and chemistry. And it's an Afrochemistry class that promises to analyze science through a contemporary African-American lens, dubbing it It's called Afrochemistry, and she's dubbing it The Study of Black Life Matter. It's a play on words, merging science jargon with, you know, Black Lives Matter movement, and begins the semester. The course description on the university's website explains students will apply chemical tools and analysis to understand black life in the U.S. and implement African-American sensibilities to analyze chemistry. Diverse historical and contemporary scientists, intellectuals, and chemical discoveries will inform personal reflections and proposals for addressing inequities in chemistry and chemical education. She's a Rice grad. Dr. Brooke Johnson is a Rice graduate with a PhD in chemistry from Princeton. She was hired last August as part of the university's DEI department. She will teach the class. The flyer, her university bio lists her as a preceptor and postdoctoral fellow. She was a former track athlete at Rice until she graduated in 2017. Passionate about the intersection of science and social justice, using her unique experiences to teach, support, and inspire diverse students. The flyer, it's a very interesting little flyer, has a flyer with a Afro woman in these green goggles and these like bubbly, you know, like cartoon bubbles with words in it. Mm-hmm. Three of them says, what does justice look like in chemistry? The other one, what does it look like to do science on one's own terms? And the third one, how does our society shape the science we do?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be quiet for a minute. You know I'm a biochemist and I'm a molecular cell biologist and biochemist. So I'm be quiet for a minute. What is your first reaction? Because the flyer, like I said, used a cartoon of a student with an Afro hairstyle pondering these questions.
Okay. So students will apply chemical tools and analysis to understand black life in the U.S. and students will implement African-American sensibilities to analyze chemistry. Diverse historical and contemporary scientists, intellectuals, and chemical discoveries will inform personal reflections and proposal for addressing inequities in chemistry and chemical education. Okay. And you are asking me what are my thoughts on this. It is a novel approach, that's for sure. I think most people would not think of the intersection of African-American life and chemistry, although we've had many noted chemists who were African-American. Some who had to really fight against the racist environments that they came up in. I don't know. I think that maybe the naming of the course as Afrochemistry was the first shot of, okay, this is going to be a problem. And maybe that is why, and maybe she wanted to provoke conversation. You know, that could be it too. It would be interesting to me to find out what is actually in the curriculum. I don't quite know what she means by students will apply chemical tools and analysis to understand black life in the U.S. and students will implement African-American sensibilities to analyze chemistry. I don't know what that means. African-American sensibilities to analyze chemistry. Diverse historical and contemporary scientists, intellectuals, and chemical discoveries will inform. I can understand that part, but we'll implement African-American sensibilities to analyze chemistry. I'm not sure what she means by that, except when we go into the color game, like black, white, that game, when we get that, when we use that language, we open ourselves up for criticism. Although we may have a good intention, we may have good content in what we're presenting, but that language, I think the language is the thing that will trip us up every time, and that we have to be wise in the language that we use if and when we want to present something that's going to force people to think differently. But you're not going to get them to think differently if you come using the same language that they are accustomed to, and actually the language that they set up to trap you. So I don't know if that answered your question, but, and I'll give this one final example. I saw a quick little TikTok. I think it must have been when Denzel Washington was in the movie Fences, because the camera shot was on him, but I thought that there was Viola Davis and the brother, I can't remember the one that played one of his sons, and there's an interviewer off camera, and she asked him the question, why did a black director have to direct this movie? And he said, it's the culture. And so she said, well, can you explain? And so she said, Denzel Washington said, Spielberg did Schindler's List. Scorsese did Goodfellas. Now, he said, now, Scorsese would have done a good job probably with Schindler's List, just as Spielberg probably would have done a good job with Goodfellas, because both of them are good directors. He said, but now you, talking to the interviewer, we don't see you, but we hear a voice. You, me, and he points to all of us here, and it looked like it was Viola Davis and this other young man that played his son. We know what it's like in the house Sunday morning when a hot comb goes through somebody's hair. We know the smell. That's culture, okay? So I think maybe if she's talking about African-American sensibilities being culture, that takes it to another dimension. And I think that's where we get tripped up when we talk about color as opposed to talking about culture. Did that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, you did. And so a little more information about the class. I like what you said about using the language that has always been used, which makes it confusing. When you use a word like chemistry to describe a course that's not teaching chemistry, it's going to cause problems, especially when you have a PhD in chemistry. So one of the things that academics were discussing when I was reading some of this and reading some of the comments was whether the course was going to have scientific study. Was it going to discuss racial politics in the field of chemistry? Is it a mix of both? What is it? Because you're not getting credit for chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it? And so there's a huge concern. And I, as a chemist and as a black person, I'm concerned. I have the same concern, because there's a lot of concern that it's going to dilute the study of science. And because you're identifying politics. And is this going to be helpful to get students to study chemistry? Right? So if the concern is, if what we are trying to do, and that's one of the things I'm trying to do, get more students into science, is this helpful? And if it is, what is the game plan? Because you can't really tell from the, either the title or the description how what's the plan, right? Now, one of the things that was mentioned is that she's a first-generation college student in a field with very few black scientists. So that makes her one of the most ideal people to talk about how race intersects with science. Yes, I understand. I agree with that. And there's some very legitimate scientific issues that might impact the black community when it comes to the environment. I do that all the time. You know, and being at Rice right there in Houston, you have the Bullard Center, which does a lot. It's one of the best places to talk about science and the environment and the intersection of how black people are affected by environmental justice and things of that nature. You have the NBEJN, the National Black Environmental Justice Network. And, you know, so there's many ways to look at that. There were some of the questions people were asking was, you know, okay, whose proposals get grants and funding and what values are represented in that through the philanthropic, who is in positions to make those influential decisions? And what's the possible impact on society in that decision making? And then I'm going to go a step further is how do we get ourselves in those spaces to make to be the decision makers? You know, do we do as I have done and Brother Fleming has done? We run for office or we get appointed on boards and commissions. We get elected on water boards or the governor or someone else to appoint us to positions of power and influence. Or as this young lady has done, get training in a field to be a professor, to be the example that others can see that of a possibility that there are this level that I can be a scientist too. Going back to your statement about when you use a title like Afrochemistry, science is not relegated to black or white or Asian or Caucasian or Italian or it's not relegated to that. Science does not have a particular race or culture attached to it. How we implement the outcome of science or medicine or engineering or technology, how we implement that in our society or in our culture may have implications for our community. But the science itself does not have that. So I think when I first heard the title, I agree with one person who said that it was a bit wince-inducing because it seems that is there science for black people and there's science for Latinos and there's science for Asians? No, there's not. So I think that's what bothers me the most is we are lending the impression that there's a different science and there is not, or a different way of looking at chemistry and there is not. And that's what was disappointing to me.
Yeah, you think that we're falling into the trap that is laid through the language, through this black-white language, and we're hurting our own selves, although our intention may be good. I'm sure there's a way, for an example, that she could have structured the course so that they could get maybe the principles of what she wants the principles of what she wants to accomplish in terms of social justice, like you said, you know, they could look at areas of environmental justice and how does chemistry, you know, solid scientific chemical knowledge play into that, and then what communities are affected by that. So perhaps she needed to have a mentor, a seasoned scientist who could help her. Because I think one thing that happens is we can attain some of these positions and we get through one level of politics. But then when you get to another level, the game is upped. You have to have another understanding of the politics of what comes to you having a certain position. You know, for an example, I'll use this political example here in the Bay Area. You know, the movement to recall the DA in this area. Okay, so she had run for that position. Pamela Price had run for that position before, and finally she gets the position. If you know you have a target on your back, even though you are able to get to a certain position, why do you do something that's going to, using your expression from earlier, shine a light on that back that has a target? Why would you hire your boyfriend in a particular position, right? Now, if you notice, mm-hmm. this is the same charge that they're trying to put on Fannie Willis down in Georgia, Fulton County, Georgia. I don't think that's right. any coincidence. I think that this is a coordinated effort to attack African-Americans who have attained those DA positions and also those DAs who might be perceived as being liberal or soft on crime or whatever else. We're going to come at them in certain ways. So I just think that there has to be a level of political education in everything that you do, that that people who are new to getting to the table, okay, for an example, when you get to the table, there's a certain etiquette at the table, all right? The etiquette that you might use in Abu Dhabi or Saudi Arabia may not be the same etiquette that you're going to use in Berkeley, California. You understand what I'm saying? Because of that mm-hmm. layer, lens of culture. Whereas right. using your hands in Abu Dhabi or Saudi Arabia or in Ghana or Senegal is appropriate, you come with your hands in so-called liberal Berkeley or San Francisco, and people are going to turn their nose up at you and feel that you are not sophisticated. You didn't use the correct etiquette. So when we get these positions, you know, we got to get schooled. I'm sorry, that's all I have to say. And so see, now controversy, they're going to blame it all on DEI. Because I think it said in the article, she was hired last August as part of the university's DEI department. You know,
exactly.
diversity. You know,
go ahead. Part of the issue was is that who was her mentor? Who part of the issue with so-called being woke is you can go too far, and people not knowing what you don't know. And
yes.
And I was looking, and I looked her up, and I was looking at it, and it was like, you don't know what you don't know. You know more than what you do. You might have your doctorate, but you have aim other than that. Somebody should have pulled you to the side and say, this is not a good idea, and the flyer is silly. You got a cartoon flyer for something as serious as chemistry. It doesn't make any sense. You could have done it. I like what you just said of the impact of chemistry and environmental justice in communities. You know, but to say the study of Black life matter. Okay, now you've just made, you've just devalued the whole Black Lives Matter movement and chemistry. what are you teaching? So these whole, you've given credence to these. So now, speaking of DEI, I'm going to add another twist. At Johns Hopkins, I don't know if you saw this one, so at Johns Hopkins, the chief diversity officer, the CDO, Sherita Hill Golden, part of her monthly diversity digest, she published what amounted to a woke hit list. She's in an email. Basically, it labeled all white people, Christians, men, and English speakers as privileged. It was posted on Twitter. Her diversity word of the month, privilege. Privilege is a set of unearned benefits given to people who are in a specific social group. Privilege operates on personal, interpersonal, cultural, and institutional levels, and it provides advantages and favors to members of dominant groups at the expense of members of other groups. In the United States, privilege is granted to people who have membership in one or more of these social identity groups. You ready for this? White people, able-bodied people, heterosexuals, cisgender people, males, Christians, middle or owning class people, middle-aged people, English-speaking people. Privilege is characteristically invisible to people who have it. People in dominant groups often believe they have earned the privileges they enjoy, or that everyone could have access to these privileges if only they worked to earn them. In fact, privileges are unearned and are granted to people in the dominant groups whether they want those privileges or not, and regardless of their stated intent. So the dean of the school of the medical faculty and the president of Johns Hopkins Health System, he wrote an apology on her, you know, for the school and on her behalf. But he did not, you know, she still gets to keep her job. But it has outraged a lot of people. I want you to think about this list. I think everybody falls in this list somewhere. White people, able-bodied people, heterosexual, cisgender, male, Christian, middle or owning class, middle age, English speaking. You've been here somewhere. Somewhere you've been in here. I'm not white, not able-bodied, got a disability. I am heterosexual, cisgender, no. Okay, male, well, maybe I am cisgender. Not male, Christian, but middle class or owning, yes. Middle age, not quite, but get in there. English speaking, yes. See? Privilege. There's other privileges. She is a privileged person. If, from writing this, she speaks English. She make a good amount of money in her position as a CDO. You know, able-bodied. And Christian. But there's other things that can give you privilege. You live indoors? Privilege. You know, all kinds of. But it was like, and this is a black woman. You're educated. You're highly educated. You have a job. You have, it's like, I just, because this goes back to the discussion of sometimes we can take this woke stuff too far. That is not what woke was supposed to be. Woke was back in the day to keep our black and brown children, keep your head on a swivel. This is, you got to know, you know, it was that speech things gave. Well, the black children before they go in. Go ahead, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I mean, sometimes it's that you can just be so educated, you just don't have common sense. Now, common sense should have, well, maybe she wanted to provoke and stir stuff up. That's the only thing that I could come out with that you would as a head of a department, that you would circulate that. I mean, technically, if you go to a class, train you in DEI, and they talk about privilege, yes, those would be categories that they are going to talk about that enjoy some privilege. Just like you said, well, I've been there somewhere. If you're trying to educate people, are you trying to educate them or are you just trying to blast their brain out of their head? I mean, what is your intent? Maybe it's being blinded by the sunlight of the position that you have achieved, that people lose all sense of strategy or what's your plan. I mean, when you have a course, you develop a curriculum. If your objective is to teach calculus, you got to make sure people that take that course, first of all, they have to know how to count. They have to know number theory, you know, so you don't just throw the, it's like you're trying to, I don't know, you're trying to use a hammer, as they say, for something that maybe you could have taken care of with your finger. You could have maybe turned the screw or use a screwdriver, but you're using a hammer to drive that that point across. People are not thinking strategically and politically when they get into those positions, and I think it is a symptom of being new to the table and to the game. So that there's an expression, you get played out of pocket. So because of your inexperience at a particular level, people can manipulate you, and you can even do it to yourself where you make a mistake, and it's a big mistake. Although you are blinded and you probably don't have the right forces around you to say, I don't know, if I were you, I don't think, this is the beauty of consensus in Al-Islam. You know what I'm saying? Get other thoughts, and I'm sure if she had good advisors and a good support system, I can hear one of her friends saying, girl, I know you're not sending that out. You're not going to have that job. You understand what I'm saying? So we can't be the lone ranger out there thinking that we're going to change everything with a newsletter. I don't know. strategy, political understanding, you know, and I understand. I've been in situations where I've been played out of pocket too. I know the feeling, you know. You think that you have, because your intention is good, that it's going to go over well. No, you have to have a good support system around you, people that you can trust and that can give you good advice and who are not afraid to tell you, you must be out of your mind if you think you're going to send this out. Johns Hopkins that stole the sister's cell, didn't she know about Henrietta? So you mean to tell me you're going to, is Johns Hopkins going to tell people about privilege? So don't get me started.
The fact that you're working at Johns Hopkins should be enough for you to go in the corner and sit down. Go in the corner and sit down, as my grandmother would say. Why are you writing this letter? Why, don't you have somebody to read your emails before you hit send?
That's what I'm saying.
Sister Sarita, come on. And you're at Johns Hopkins Medical. You're at the medical center. You ain't even at the regular school. You're at the medical center. Come on. Hurt my
ears. And you're going to be talking about privilege to a school or a center full of doctors. Of course doctors are privileged in this society. I mean,
and it's not even... it is even and more insulting is a privileged like Johns Hopkins.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Johns Hopkins is the one of the epitome of privilege. You know, they are an extremely privileged institution. And really? And you didn't do anything. But the thing is that she won't face any consequences, so that was her. So that was in connection with the other Rice Afrochemistry debacle. I will keep an eye on how that class is progressing, since we don't know, you know, what exactly is happening with that class. But we will see. But in the age where we're going, like my grandmother used to forward, and you know, one step forward, two steps back. Is that just? Yeah.
Well, this is why we need more education in the area of civic and political engagement.
Yes,
we really.
Yes.
And stressing, I'm not just stressing, you know, what you can learn at any institution, any college or university or high school or whatever, but also from the Islamic perspective of how do you build consensus? Because that process of building consensus will make you more sensitive to the politics of whatever you're trying to do, because you will be getting a view of people that are engaged in the process of consensus. And that should make you more sympathetic and empathetic to what could be the impact of what you do. You know, if those two sisters, if their intent was not to provoke, I mean, sometimes people will do things just to provoke, just to stir up stuff. And they might feel that, okay, we got to shake this up so that we can make some change. You know, some people use that as a strategy. But if that were not their impact, then somewhere along the line, they didn't get the understanding of the importance of consensus building when you're going to try and bring about change. Otherwise,
right. People
are going to be trying to sabotage you from left and right, because
right. They
haven't bought into it. They haven't committed to whatever it is you're trying to do. So we have to get on.
And so even on that note, that reminds me, there was something you said that got me to thinking, because, you know, the differences between how... Even though I don't agree with either one of these approaches, look at the difference between not just these two sisters, but when we were talking about like Dr. Claudine Gay and Dr. Bailey from Lincoln University, and just the lack of compassion and the lack of empathy for those two. And Mr. Ackman, who's been going after, and he said he's going to go after all of these colleges because he doesn't like DEI, right?
Right.
That's his shtick. He's Bill Ackman, right? He's Harvard grad, and he's just sick of DEI. So I'm going to go after her. And then he publicly campaigned against Gay until she resigned as the president of Harvard. And she disgraced my Harvard. And, you know, and her plagiarism was just unacceptable until they came and his wife, and she was like, I asked you to be quiet, because she knew she had played right. you could almost envision her in the background, like, would you be quiet? You know what the wives be like, now I told you to be quiet, but here you go out here running your mouth, and look what you done done. Mm-hmm. Now you got these people coming after you, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, people coming after her, and she is, so after this long list of complaints about everybody else that he's been going after, at Penn and Cornell and Harvard, and he comes out a couple of days ago, and he's mad at Business Insider for printing all of these instances of his wife, and he comes out and he says his wife has already admitted to 4 missing quotation marks and 1 missed footnote. And 330 pages, not all. She has done much more than 4 missing quotation marks. And it was like she lifted entire, you know, paragraphs and pages. He said the articles could have, literally killed his wife if not for the support of her family and friends. And then on X, he wrote, she has suffered severe emotional harm, and as an introvert, it has been very, very difficult for her to make it through each day. Now, this woman is a speaker, sister. She gets paid to be a speaker.
Alone a privileged wife of a billionaire. Let's put in privilege
Thank
in that
you.
One.
But it's been very, very difficult for her. This is what he said. Now, when Claudine Gay came out and wrote in the Times about her experience, he dismissed it. She said that those who campaigned to have her ousted often trafficked in lies and ad hominem insults, not reasoned arguments. She was the subject of death threats and had been called the N-word more times than I care to count. Now, he had no comment. He said that she deserved what she got, and he had not 1 ounce of empathy for her for death threats, being called outside her name that her mama gave her, her grandma, whoever. Right. Her name is Claudine. Her name had no, she had 1 N, and it is not at the beginning of her name. And she'd been, I mean, death threats, they trafficked in all kind of lies against this woman. But yet your wife
and
is in there.
It was an organized effort, part of their scheme. And as he said in that posting that he did in X, they're going to continue to target other folks. Now, I would not be surprised if all the folks that they target happen to have a little melanin in them or maybe speak with an accent. And you mentioned him as a Harvard grad. You know, Josh Hawley, Elise Stefanik, the guy Ruffo, I believe. These are all people who are Harvard grad. The attorney who, I want to go to this because this was just, you didn't ask me about if my hate ad was on straight this morning, but I'm going to tell you, this is something that, you know, in the Exorcist, when the girl's head spins around, well, this had my hate ad spinning around. The attorney, I think his name is Sawyer, something like that, who did the oral arguments before the appeals court for 45, appeal on the January 6th case that the president has absolute immunity. Now, this gave me a chuckle. My husband and I, we laughed about this. So, Trump 45, he had to look up
and he saw three women on that panel. He saw an African-American, he saw an Asian-American, and this other judge, the media, they said he saw a woman 2 years older than him. They didn't have to put her age out there, but they did. So he's looking at those three women who hold their fate, a part of his fate, in their hands. And then the Asian sister, she asked his lawyer, so are you saying that if the President of the United States ordered the SEAL Team 6, you know, these are supposed to be the bad guys, they took out, so they say, Osama, and, you know, you don't mess with him. If he orders them to execute his political rival, are you saying that he, the president, is not accountable for that? Those aren't her exact words, but that's what she was saying. And he said, the lawyer replies, well, if only if he has gone through the process that the Constitution lays out as far as being impeached and being found guilty through that process. So she's saying, so if the president orders SEAL Team 6 to kill a political rival and he has not been convicted through the impeachment process, then he would not be accountable? Well, that's a qualified yes. And she said, I'm asking a yes or a no. I was just cracking up. He is a Harvard grad also. So Harvard, I don't know what kind of water they're giving those guys at Harvard Law School, but it certainly is something. I thought Alan Dershowitz was just crazy, but I see all of them must have studied under Alan Dershowitz for some of the preposterous positions that they take. So people like Bill Ackman, Mr. Harvard himself, they think that they are so far above the law that they can do whatever they want to do. That's why they support people like 45. Now, Sister Golden, that is what you call privilege, definitely privilege with a capital P. And Elise Stefanik from New York, she is right in there with the. She was trying to call for the brother Lloyd Austin for his firing, because he didn't let Biden know he was gone in the hospital. That's a whole. We need a whole program to go over that one, because that was so bizarre. But I think he just wants to get out of that administration so they don't arrest him for being part of that war crimes charge that people are trying to bring against him. But I want to say to our audience before we leave, there is a good website I found out about called Open Secrets. One word, Open, OpenSecrets. .org. And you know that we've said on this program many times, you got to follow that money to those politicians to see why are they voting as crazy as they're voting. And on this website, you will find information on who is getting money from what organizations, what lobbyists, what PACs. It's a good resource to find. Go check out the politicians in your area, your congressperson, your senator, even some local politicians, and see who is funding their campaigns. And you will see that it is unbelievable the amount of money these politicians get. And I recall they're saying the thing that made Kevin McCarthy so valuable to the GOP was his ability to raise money. And he had, I think it was $800,000 that he had raised. This was for 22, I believe it was. So opensecrets.org. the research think tank. Their website is a good source for researching the sources for politicians' money. And look at that. Look at who your representative is and ask them, why are you voting this way? You get 300,000. You got 300,000 from AIPAC. Is that why you're not calling for a ceasefire? We might be surprised what kind of answers we get. So anyway, I diverge. So back to you, Shel.
That's good. Good information too. I think it's good. There was one more in that vein on MLK. There was when you mentioned McCarthy, I ran across an article where Martin Luther King's daughter condemned him for his speech and for invoking his name. So that was another one. And one on that one is that there was a GOP candidate, Mark Robinson, who is the leading Republican candidate to be North Carolina's next governor. And I want anybody in North Carolina to pay attention, because you listen to what they say, He called Martin Luther King Jr., Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he called him just an ursus pastor and a communist. He called the 1960s civil rights movement crap. His Facebook post, Lieutenant Governor, he regularly criticized King and the civil rights movement for years on Facebook, specifically on this holiday. And he, so-called black politician, he's been downplaying slavery, rejected the idea that he's part of the so-called African-American community, and he even attacked the late Congressman and civil rights icon John Lewis. See, now, because he's on track to be the GOP nominee for governor, and I think he did make it, right? But he is, you know, he's trying to downplay that because he's a fan of, you know, 45. 45 has backed him. And he even said on one of his campaign trails, 45 said that he's better than Dr. Martin Luther King at a campaign event. And Robinson said he took it as a compliment. And he said, knowing what I know about him in the history, you know, those are big shoes to fill. But social media says that, you know, he's been... His name is Mark Keith Robinson. In January 2018, he mocked people who celebrate King, who he said was such just a subpar pastor. He didn't mention him by name, but he said, it is at once funny and sad that so many people will follow the lead of a bunch of atheists and worship an ursus pastor as a deity. He also dismissed the idea that racism is real. The state of race relations exists chiefly within your own mind. Free at last, and God Almighty, you're free at last. Now what? That's what he wrote on his social media. They came 1 year after he broke K-Day to show that he wasn't a leech on society and allowing the government to cut him a break. I don't like communists, no matter what color they are. These are some of the things he said. So, North Carolina, do what you do. This man is doing this because he also wrote in 2017, he attacked John Lewis, who nearly lost his life fighting for voting rights. He wrote, hey, John Lewis, just because you got beat up by some Democrats in 1965 doesn't mean you can't get criticized by some Republicans in 2017. He says, slavery of the mind is far worse than physical slavery. slavery of the mind cannot be seen, cannot be made illegal, and is and always has been the greatest tool Satan used against man and men against each other. I agree with that in a way. I just don't agree with him saying that slavery wasn't anything at all, that there wasn't any actual real-life slavery. Said that he didn't care what Lewis did.
For governor of North Carolina.
He is, yes. He said he didn't care what Lewis did in the 60s because the problem was what Lewis was doing in 2017 because Lewis was calling out 45 for not being a legitimate president.
Yeah.
He said, oh, there's more. Don't realize that the real civil rights movement started in the 1860s. That crap in the 1960s was the communist rise movement. Oh, there's it. He said, here's the part that Muslims may want to. He said, going back further, in 2015, civil rights movement was never about giving rights to people. So what about setting the stage to take people's rights away? The year before that, he wrote that the racial integration was never about freedom, but about destroying black people and the bondage of their minds. He's already known for his wildly offensive comments about women, LGBTQ people, and Muslims, in addition to fueling bonkers conspiracy theories. The reason he's still the Republican frontrunner for governor is because he's modeled himself after 45. A strategy that some North Carolina political analysts predict will fail him in the general election in swing state. Yeah, he did not respond for comment.
Well, North Carolina, we're depending on you. Muslims in North Carolina. Oh, I said North Carolina, we're depending on you. Muslims in North Carolina, all you good folks down there, Muslims, Christians, Jews, everyone. Got to get to the polls, and you got to make sure you don't elect this fool.
Oh, sit him down. Yeah, I got you. Sit him in the corner. Let my grandmother say it. Sit him in the corner. He needs some unemployment. He needs to go and eat some of that government cheese that he don't like. Sit him in the corner. Let him understand what he's like. He needs to sit in the corner.
You,
you
know, that people feel they have to sell out their souls to get to a point that they've set for their goal. Here's a King quote. This is one that I really like. Vanity asks, is it popular? Politics asks, will it work? But conscience and morality ask, is it right?
Yeah, I like that one. Yes.
So
it's a good one.
Yeah.
That is.
Alhamdulillah.
But I thought that was a good one too. We have to make sure that we know what we're talking about, when that we hold that up. The last one that's been controversial this week, and I want to ask you about, we got a few more minutes, is Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. He developed a severe infection after surgery for his prostate cancer on December 22nd, and he was admitted to Walter Reed National Military Medical Center on the 1st. He, this part, it's kind of interesting to me. They said he failed for days to inform the White House and Congress of his diagnosis, his treatment, and his eventual return to the hospital. And the lack of communication between the Pentagon, the White House, and Congress about his serious illness has sparked a lot of outrage and multiple investigations. But the man was in the hospital for an emergency treatment. So what do you want him to do? Hey, doc, could you stop for a second? Let me text my boss real quick before you do surgery and tell them that I'm in. I'm not understanding. They mad because he didn't tell them he didn't publish he's still protected. No matter
HIPAA.
He's still protected under HIPAA.
Yes.
You just mad because you couldn't get I mean, and the fact that you're letting out this sensitive information on the news wire is still a problem for me. You could have told him he had a serious medical condition, but to say what it is, I don't know, sister. I'm still happy.
Well, I think the White House probably pressured him to have that doctor to release his information like that, because I'm sure that doctor wouldn't just have released that information on his own. And probably in reaction to knuckleheads like, okay, I got to, Allah forgive me, as Representative Elise Stefanik. She was the first one that was out of the box asking or demanding that he be fired. So the thing that was interesting to me was that they didn't already have a protocol in place. From what they have said, they're doing an investigation, they're going to see this, that, and the other. It seems like they did not have the protocol in place. And that is strange to me, not just for him, but for any cabinet member. But for him, you know, it's important, too, because I'll tell you the truth, when I first heard that he was sick, I said, oh, they probably tried to kill that brother when he went over to the Middle East. But forgive me for that thought. But he, again, you know, we're talking about African Americans who are in high place positions. You are
exactly
a target. You have to be, you have to know that you're a target.
Mindful,
what,
right.
What's going on? Is it, you know, they say in Denver the air is lighter too, and in Mexico City the air is lighter. The higher up you go, the thinner the air is. I don't know what it is, but you have to, the people who ascend to these high positions, they have to learn how to protect themselves and to have good support around them. You know, otherwise you're just going to be another statistic of another one that they're going to point to that say, oh, they couldn't handle it. This is why they're not in these positions in the first place. But I pray Allah bless the brother to recuperate. I believe that he's back home now. I hope that he has a good recuperation. And whatever Allah has decreed, if he's to keep his position, he'll keep it. And if he keeps it, I pray that he will, talk some sense into Biden's head and say, look, we got to get out of this situation that we're in.
Yeah, that's a good, glad you said that, because, so we started off talking about how hard it is to be, you know, the black woman, so I wanted to end on that about, it's just black, period, in these high power positions. And so I wanted to say, we only got a couple minutes, but I wanted to give somewhat, give everybody just some practical advice. We are, the winter season is upon us. Even out here in California, we are not used to this disrespectful weather. We like it. We like the sun shining, and they have bamboozled us with this cold. We're not used to that. So I just wanted to give you something real practical before we get out of here. Instead of running up really cold, really high bills, and you don't want to turn on the heat, no problem. Here's how to stay warm in your bed without the heater. Try something practical, because we know that the winter season is notorious for bumping up your energy usage in your household, so especially heating. So, change your cost of living. So that it's the crisis right now. Everybody's spending money on everything else. And so everybody's desperate, especially at night. We don't want you to break the bank. So try some practical things. Three things. Wear some pajamas. I know it's obvious. Get some nice, thick, warm pajamas. Put them on in bed, and it could save you a considerable amount of money. Layer it up. Invest in some thermal wands if you can. So thermal wands are designed to keep you warm throughout the night. Here's one that might not sound so obvious. Exercise at night. If you exercise before bed, it will increase your body temperature, and it kind of acts like an internal blanket that will help you fall asleep, and it will regulate that body temperature throughout the night. Any amount of physical activity will tire you out, and it will make it easier for you to drift away. And this last one, if you have a mate, you know, if you don't have a mate, get a good pillow. Get a good pillow or a warm blanket, throw it in the dryer, because the body heat or the external heat will help you cuddle up. It'll also, you know, keep you warm and improve your mood. And with that, sisters, anything else? We've got about 90 seconds before I take us out of here.
No, I don't think I can say anything else except to encourage people to join in 150, which is the support for the Clara Muhammad School. The school that is being supported this month is the Clara Muhammad School in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at 317 West Wright Street, Milwaukee, Wisconsin 53212. You can also go to their website, www.cmsmkewi.us, and click on the donate button. The Support Independent Education, Clara Muhammad School.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. Inshallah, we will see you next Monday, same channel, same time. Enjoy the rest of your day. If you change the way you look at things, the things you look at will also change. Have a wonderful, wonderful day and a wonderful, wonderful week. Do something to help your community. Stay engaged. Stay grateful. Stay powerful. Peace. Assalamualaikum. Thank you.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I mean.